If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. And the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. We got a jam-packed show. Hope you hang around for it. Hey, Stephen Lecce is going to be joining us a little later on. And reason being is that they've settled all the school contract stuff. I know. Isn't that amazing? It's like for 100 years, we've been threatened with a strike of some sort, and they've all settled. It's all gone to arbitration, and bing, bang, boom, Bob's your uncle. Why didn't we do this before? Why didn't we just, you know, go right to this point? So anyway, we're going to be talking about that a little later on, and Minister Lecce is going to be joining us. Hey, how's your Facebook and Instagram? Sorry. Why don't you just relax for a bit? Put that thing down. What else we got? Two-thirds of Canadians oppose the carbon tax increase coming April 1st. There's your April Fool's joke, that a Lecce survey. And it's interesting, the NDP, and I don't know, I remember having this battle way back when the Conservatives sold, boneheadedly, sold the 407, stupidest thing Mike Harris ever did, and everybody will admit that since on pretty much every stripe. So it's gone. And I remember everybody fighting with the McGuinty government, trying to get the tolls lowered, let the tolls lowered. And you can't do that because it's a privately owned company, except for the piece east of Pickering, which is much cheaper than the privately owned portion. And, you know, it's in the middle of nowhere. It's going from Pickering East. So it's not even going to across the top of the city. So we've been down this road a bazillion times. So the NDP wants to subsidize rigs to run on the 407. In other words, pay their tolls. So I don't know. So they can free up the 401, which was the whole reason the 407 was built. And again, the 401's congested. There's nobody on the 407 because it costs too much. So failed experiment there. But I'm not sure the answer is subsidizing and paying the tolls of trucks to drive on the highway and give that to a private company. It's just amazing. And we've been down this road a bazillion times. Mistake made. There you go. Move on and learn from it. But we'll talk about that coming up a little later on and find out exactly where everybody's head is on that. All right. The salamander, the endangered salamander, the species, you know, yep, the roads are closed. Tolls or no tolls? Hardly. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. Colin DeMello is going to join us to talk about what the whole 407 toll thing is all about. And good news that no serious injuries in that school bus crash near Woodstock. And boy, what a frightening time that was. A bus loaded with like 40 students on its side, and luckily minor injuries there. So good news all around. The cyber attack, City Hall, boy, that's turning out to be a much deeper hole than we all thought way back when. We'll try to get you an update on that as well. And as I mentioned, Education Minister Stephen Lecce joining us coming up at about 4:20 to talk about the fact that all of the unions for the next 3 years are in good shape as far as deals signed and no more strikes. So there we go. Going to talk about that. Also an update on that Winnipeg lab leak coming up a little later on. And PharmaCare. Not many calling it PharmaCare now because it's not really PharmaCare. And there's really no financial commitment for this until at least 2025, 26 budget. So again, it's, I don't know what it is, but we'll ask more questions as that continues to unfold for, at least pharmacy goods in and around, diabetes and birth control. So we'll talk about that coming up a little later on. You know, the weather's been a little wacky this year, in case you haven't noticed. And, you know, some things are a little earlier, what have you. Nature's a little confused. Wait till the eclipse. You have cows mooing and dogs barking at 3 p.m. All right, enough of that. But the annual road closure in Burlington for the endangered salamander species is happening early this year. obviously as a result of the mild weather. City of Burlington closing a portion of King Road starting March 5th to allow for the safe migration of this local endangered species, the Jefferson salamander. To talk more about all of this, Gabriella Zagorski is with us, monitoring technician with Conservation Halton. And here now, Gabriella, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Hi, thank you for having me. I am. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. So give us a little lesson here. Tell us what this Jefferson salamander is and what is happening at this time of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Jefferson salamander is from a group that's called the mole salamanders. They spend most of their time underground. And so right now what's happening with these salamanders is as the temperatures start to warm up, so around 5 degrees consistently at nighttime, we get some more precipitation. The salamanders start to make a mass migration from the areas they were spending their winter over to the pools where they will be breeding.
So where do they spend the winter and where do they breed?
Yeah, absolutely. So they spend their winter below the frost line. And so they will sort of crawl under the ground. They'll go in between the cracks of, you know, little air pockets from the roots of trees. They'll go into old small mammal burrows. They'll go into the fissures of the cracks of the rocks along the escarpment. And they breed in vernal pools. So what these are is they are pools of water that are only wet seasonally. So they normally dry up by around, you know, mid to late summer. And so these salamanders head to these pools and they will breed aquatically and lay their eggs in the water.
What is the life cycle of a salamander?
Yeah, absolutely. So these salamanders have a terrestrial and aquatic life cycle. And so they, as adults, they're terrestrial, but when they lay their eggs in the water, those salamanders that hatch out are actually, they have gills and they're aquatic until about a couple of months. And then they emerge from the water. And then those salamanders go into the terrestrial habitat, so into the forest.
Why is this a big deal? Why do we have to do this?
Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to the salamander, as you already mentioned, they are an endangered species. They could disappear really easily if we don't take these steps to protect them. So if you think about it, when you have salamanders, they're pretty slow moving. And when they go to cross the road, it's really, really easy for them to get hit by things like cars or cyclists or even people walking, you know, if they're not watching where they're stepping. And so when you lose, you know, one individual, maybe five individuals every single year, eventually there's not going to be any left.
So how long does this take, and how do you know when they've started, when they finished, when things can continue back to normal?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. I mean, with nature, you can never put exact timelines on it.
Yeah.
But again, like I was mentioning, they start when the temperature and the weather kind of lines up with that 5 degrees consistently at nighttime. And when we get a little bit more rain, this can go for, you know, a couple of weeks. And so what we look for is when we do surveys for them, we'll go to the vernal pools and we'll see if there are eggs. We'll see if there are larvae that are hatching out. And normally most of them have made it to those vernal pools and have laid some eggs, I'd say by, you know, the start of April.
And so what is it like when this is during its peak? Is it literally, they're everywhere across the road? I mean, I think I've sort of seen this in other with other species and such over time, but is it literally just like a herd of these things?
Yeah, it absolutely can be if you catch it at the right times. There can be multiple, numerous, you know, in their 20s of individuals moving at the same time. In other areas with other species of salamanders and other amphibians, you can get hundreds of thousands of individuals crossing at the same time.
Where are they in the food chain? Why is it important to keep these from going farther and becoming endangered?
Yeah, absolutely.
More endangered.
So they eat a lot of invertebrates, and then they also are eaten by a lot of things such as birds, small mammals, raccoons, and the like. Yeah.
So what is the reaction from this? Because I know this has been going on for a long time, but I guess people are just used to it now.
You know what? It's kind of hard to tell because we at Conservation Halton don't get, you know, too many of people's reactions, but we try our best and we work with, you know, the city of Burlington, the city of Hamilton, as well as Halton Police on this project to make sure we're getting the word out to everybody. We have really clear signage and that everyone kind of understands what's going on. And obviously, even just talking on shows like this to let people know what's happening.
And what makes the Jefferson salamander so great? What is it about this species?
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of a lot of the things that we just mentioned, they span both aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems. So they provide a really good link in different food webs. They're an indicator of really high quality vernal pools. So these are pools that can stay, you know, wet and hold water for long periods of time. And they aren't just important for life cycles, but they're important for a number of different amphibian, invertebrate, and different species life cycles.
And how are we?
Oh, go ahead.
How are we doing? Are they increasing in population?
Yeah, unfortunately, we haven't been able to do studies to see if they're increasing at this point. We are actually starting a study this year to hopefully be able to understand what that population size looks like a little bit. But the best thing that we can do is protect this habitat. And we do that by this, implementing this road closure.
King Road closed from North Service Road to Mountain Brow Road until April 2nd, when the salamanders are expected to finish their breeding period. Gabriella, thank you for the time. Good luck this year.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
And here we are talking about tolls. Wow, it's like it's 20 years ago. And you might remember they built a highway called the 407. I remember being in high school and taking a local history class and them talking about this. Eventually, it got built. And then, unfortunately, Mike Harris made the mistake of his life and sold the dang thing and to somebody far, far away who really has control over the whole thing as far as what we pay for tolls, all that sort of thing. And I remember McGuinty government fighting against this and trying to come up with solutions. And there's really nothing to do. The horse was out of the barn and we have what we have. Now, the portion east of Pickering, I believe, around Brock is owned by the province, and that still goes, but that's between Pickering and Peterborough. There's not much going on there at this point, and it certainly is tolled at a much lower rate than across the top of Toronto. So now we're talking about tolls that have just come into the conversation, but also NDP leader Merritt Stiles today saying she wants to get the trucks moved off of 401 onto the 407, which was the whole idea in the first place. But how do you do that when the company controls the tolls unless you pay for the toll fares for trucks? Let's bring in Colin DeMello, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Global News. He is here now. Colin, thanks for the time. Hope you're doing well.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So give us some toll clarification here. What exactly is Merritt Stiles proposing here?
Well, the NDP was proposing rerouting trucks, heavy transport trucks, commercial vehicle trucks from the 401 onto the 407 as a way to kind of ease the congestion on the 401 and have, you know, an uninterrupted flow for the commercial trucking industry all the way across the 407. Now, the question of who was going to pay for the tolls was an interesting one. The Green Party has also suggested something similar. Their suggestion was to have taxpayers foot the bill for the tolls. But the Ontario NDP wanted the Ford government to try to negotiate with the 407 owners some kind of, you know, tax or toll exemption for commercial trucking. Either way, though, it didn't pass through the Ontario legislature because the Ontario Progressive Conservatives shot it down.
We've already been through this years ago when the Liberal government came in prior to this one, way back when, and tried to get the company, whether it was legal means or whatever. Hasn't this ship sailed? Is there many options here other than, of course, paying the truckers tolls?
Yeah, well, that is an interesting question. I mean, the NDP yesterday weren't really able to demonstrate what mechanism the Ontario government could use to, you know, force a reopening of a contract. I mean, there isn't really an operating contract with a 407, right? I mean, this thing has been sold off. There are some liabilities and obligations that the 407 might have to the Ontario government, but beyond that, you know, it's unclear what leverage the Ford government does have, which is why then it would fall onto taxpayers potentially to foot the bill for all of this. But we don't know exactly how much that would cost. But either way, though, what the NDP was trying to do here was to wedge the Ford government, right? They introduced a piece of legislation a couple of weeks ago that explicitly declared themselves as the anti-toll government.
Yeah.
Well, the one highway that actually does have a toll that a lot of people get quite annoyed about is the Highway 407. And it seems like the government either cannot or will not do anything about that one. And that was, I think, the point that the NDP was looking to make.
Do you mean the portion that they own, that Ontario still owns? So the remaining part that was built, the second part?
Well, the entire thing, to be honest. I mean, you know, yes, the provincial portion of the 407, which is kind of really in the east end of the GTA, Pickering, Ajax, etc., that is the portion that the government does have control over, and they could take the taxes off of that fairly easily, but the government has chosen not to. And on top of that, the entire 407 as well, there are some politicians who are arguing, if you can't take the tolls off, maybe you can foot the bill for the tolls so that, truckers can get their goods from point A to point B much faster, and they could maybe take some congestion off the highways themselves. So it was a way to kind of put the government into a sticky, interesting position, and the NDP seemed to have done that pretty well.
Does anyone know how much it would cost for us to subsidize truckers' tolls on the 407?
No, and in fact, I had an interesting conversation yesterday with the Ontario Trucking Association. They said that, largely they're in favor of the idea of, having these, having more commercial vehicle traffic on the 407. They said for the past 10 years, they've been trying to negotiate with the owners of the 407 a discounted rate for commercial trucking. But they have not been able to get any kind of number or figure or even proposal from the owners of the 407. So it seems like from all angles, this issue is a bit dead in the water, largely because of an unwillingness to either, cut the rates for truckers or to subsidize them completely. So it seems like the idea is dead in the water. But I mean, if you ask a computer who's stuck in the car on the 401 right now, sitting behind a transport truck, or, maybe there's one in front of you, behind you, and on both sides of you, you're thinking to yourself, hey, you would pay anything to get traffic moving a little bit faster.
And again, I remember when it was being built, that was the whole idea behind the 407, was to relieve the congestion off of the 401. But then we have what we have, and high tolls are obviously taking its toll. Do you see this as being dead in the water, or is it already business that's had, or what about relieving some tax on this? Is there tax on this they could be taking off, I guess, your fee?
Well, look, I'll put it to you this way. Anytime the issue comes up, the Ford government doesn't even mention the 407. They start talking about the 413. Now, what is the 413, you might ask? It's a highway that doesn't exist, that the government is looking to build. They don't have all of the approvals to actually build it. And the highway would, if they get all the green lights, would take something like 10 years to actually build and cut through a lot of farmers' fields, and also kind of replicate a bit of the 407 route anyway. The government has put a lot of their eggs in the 413 basket. And anytime you talk about traffic congestion today, they talk about the need to build the 413 sometime in the future. So that is their principal primary goal here. It's to build this highway that would be available to drivers, in the distant future, and wouldn't necessarily provide relief today. That seems to be their primary focus. So if you ask if the 407 proposals are dead in the water, it doesn't seem like this government in particular is putting much stock in that idea.
It's interesting. If you need another highway, build it above the toll highway. I guess that's the direction we're going in. It's a very bizarre discussion. Colin DeMello trying to help us through it. Queen's Park Bureau Chief, Global News. Make sure you're watching Global Tonight for more on all of this. Thank you, Colin. Be well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This was a tragic story. And man, as soon as you see and hear images of this, about images and incidents like this, you cringe and you hope everybody is okay. But let's get an update on that school bus crash, which was near Woodstock, Ontario. Full bus load of students, it looks like, and it looks also as if the miracle is that there were no real serious injuries. Kevin Nielsen is with us, Global News online journalist in KW and here now. Kevin, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Thanks, Scott. I'm doing well. Thanks.
So obviously, everybody's heart just sinks when you hear and see something like this. What can you tell us? What happened, and how is everybody doing?
So I guess about 8 o'clock this morning, there was a school bus with about 40 kids in it that rolled over into a ditch. It was about 10 kilometers south of Woodstock where it happened. I drove out to get some footage and some pictures later this in the morning. And, you know, as you said, it was kind of a minor miracle when you see the bus the way it was once they had stood. As I drove up, they were just hauling the bus out of the ditch off of its side. And one of the kids had been pinned under the bus. And once we heard that, it was definitely, you know, a little scary to hear that. And that they had been airlifted to hospital in London. And then later the police said it was just, there's five kids that got hurt on the bus and they just suffered minor injuries. So it could have been so much worse.
So we did hear, Kevin, earlier about that child that had been pinned, but that seems that not serious as we first thought, and everybody appears to be okay.
Yeah, it sounds like OPB say that he was just, he or she was just airlifted to the hospital in London just as a precautionary measure to make sure there was no internal injuries. And it turns out that they were cleared, and I guess they didn't say exactly what the injuries were, but they were minor.
And single vehicle accident, is that accurate?
Yeah, it's out in the sort of middle of nowhere where it happened. It's not quite a dirt road, but it's out in a farmer's field, so.
Right.
Like I said, I guess it was on a dirt road now that I think about it. But it definitely could have been, like I said, a lot worse.
So anything on the driver, any ideas to what happened or what caused this?
No, I guess that's still under investigation at the moment by police. Cause it was, there was no indication of how it happened yet.
And, the driver, okay. The driver not hurt?
As far as we know, there was no injuries to the driver. Just the five children were injured.
And how did the kids get from the accident scene home? Did people come out? Were they all transported back? What happened to the kids after the accident? And I understand there were some good Samaritans that certainly stopped and helped out.
Yeah, the police were crediting a couple of people that had obviously reached the scene before they did with they were very, very much trying to push the message that they were thanking them. So they had arrived on the scene, I guess, early and helped the kids to get off the bus and into safety. I'm not sure what they did with the kids after. I'm assuming the kids got the day off school for sure. They did contact all the parents early so that anybody who thought their kid may have been on the bus and was worried, they were not contacted. So they made that message clear as well.
All right. So at the end of the day, I guess now, Kevin, it appears that everybody is okay. Just an investigation moving forward into the cause of this.
Yeah, and I think you'll see some more, at least a little bit of calls for more school bus safety. I haven't been inside the school bus in quite some time now, but, I always kind of wondered how they take these buses onto the highways and stuff and don't have any seatbelts. So
yeah,
one would think that might be a good idea.
Has that been mentioned at all in any of this, in the investigation so far? Because as you said, full school bus, no seatbelts usually.
Yeah, I know. I haven't seen any mention of it at all, but I know you may see a piece on globalnews.ca tomorrow morning talking about school bus safety. So keep your eyes peeled for that.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you, sir. It was nice talking to you.
It is Kevin Nielsen with us, Global News online journalist covering Kitchener-Waterloo and the situation near Woodstock, Ontario. A rural road, really, as Kevin said, an area road between farms, basically. And one vehicle, that being the bus, loaded, obviously, with kids, about 40 of them, and then going off the road down a steep ditch, if you think about what any country road looks like, and then getting down into the field and ending up on its side. So, and it's as Kevin mentioned, it'll be interesting if this stimulates a discussion again about whether it is worth it to have seatbelts on buses or what the logic is for not or such. It'll be interesting to see if that comes up. 40 kids, bus on its side. You could imagine what that would have been like inside. So good news is no severe injuries out of that bus crash at Woodstock, Ontario.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
I was saying this earlier in the show that I can remember being at the Canadian National Exhibition as a kid. I think we were in high school, grade 9 or grade 10 or something like that, and calling my mom and saying, "Do we have to come home? Is there school tomorrow?" And we used to watch like the flip read on Cable 10, the cable network, and say, oh, well, they're back to school. No, you got to come home. So, and we couldn't stay up late out that day. And you know, as I became an adult and got married and have kids, my kids had lost musicals and sports and whatever through extracurricular loss or strikes of some sort. And it just seemed that every few years we're having this discussion and have had it for 30 years or so. And it looks like that cycle has come to an end. The Ontario government is celebrating a tentative central agreement with the Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association, which means I think this is the last one signed on and we're free for another 3 years. Let's bring in Stephen Lecce, Minister of Education, Province of Ontario, and here now. Stephen, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Thank you, Scott. Good to be back.
This is quite an accomplishment, isn't it?
It's the first, really, in almost a generation where a government has been able to land deals with all the teacher unions that has averted any strikes or withdrawal services, be it locally in one-off boards or provincially. And it is an achievement, but it's the winner here are our kids because they are staying in school. And that consistency in their routine was a solemn commitment that the Premier and I and others made to families. After so many years of difficulty, strikes in the pandemic, we had to get back to basics and we had to keep our kids in school. And so we are delivering on both. And I'm just very elated that this stability comes at a critical time where we're starting to see incrementally kids moving in the right direction on literacy and math scores according to EQAO. But we're not, you know, all the investments, you know, the new math standards, the new math curriculum, the mandatory financial literacy and coding, all these reforms that are good, positive, common sense changes will have no impact unless we keep the kids in school. So the first principle was stability. We delivered it. And I'm just happy for families, frankly, across Hamilton and right across Ontario. Every child deserves that peace. And today with the Catholic teachers, we got it done.
I guess the big question is how? What's different now? Why have things changed? Now, I know there has been some change in some of the leadership positions over the last couple of years with some of these unions. It seemed at one time it was quite a militant group. Has that softened?
I mean, compared to the last round, perhaps that was you're being in your descriptions, but you know, I think that activism still exists within the unions. I just think perhaps they've become a little bit more sophisticated to read the room, and the appetite of families for the withdrawal of service or a strike was precisely zero. So I think they recognize that they had to work with government to come up with a program that was frankly fair for their workers, but you know, good for the kids. And I think we could actually say, you know, we delivered an outcome that definitely is positive for families, but it's also good for workers too. They're getting guaranteed stability. They're able to be in the classroom. And so I think the other element that changed was that the government tabled a proposal to send all outstanding disputes to binding arbitration, where an independent individual, we all mutually decide upon, ultimately lands the outcome if we just can't agree in good faith. And I'm happy we proposed that. The unions did not love it at the start, but they've all embraced it by the end, and they all signed deals that have 80, 90% ratification, which is an overwhelming endorsement from their members that this program, this framework, if you will, the proposal the government tabled was sensible, was reasonable. And I made a commitment we would do whatever it takes to keep these kids in school. We've done so. And I think, look, sometimes it's got to be a bit innovative, think outside the box. But, you know, the mission was stability, and we're providing it for kids for 3 years. And I'm telling you, there's nothing more important. There's no greater currency. There's no greater investment that one can make in providing the kids the routine that they're with their friends, they're in front of their teachers, they're learning the curriculum, and they're getting that well-rounded experience, which includes even the things that happen outside the classroom, like the clubs and the sports and the competitive elements within our school system. That's also very critical that carries on in the life of a child. So look, good outcome, long process, but we got it done. And I just want families in Hamilton to know, be it public or Catholic, English or French, that their children will have stability for the next 3 years.
Binding arbitration too costly, that's been suggested.
You know, we'll see what comes of the results. I mean, keep in mind, we use this process for so many other ministries and sectors of the economy, nurses and transit workers and energy workers and a ton of others. So, you know, there's lots of precedent for it. I don't hear, you know, that type of commentary for those sectors that they've been doing them for decades. But look, you know, obviously I'm a fiscally conservative person. I believe in government has to live within their means. We do pay our educators the top paid in the country, but you know, we've always said we want to be reasonable. We want to retain the workers. What we were going to put our foot down on or a red line on is the insistence that kids stay in school. So we came up with a proposal that works. The majority of issues we actually negotiated at the table, a small amount, you know, maybe in some cases it was one issue, like literally just negotiated, just the compensation went to the arbitrator. In some cases it was three or four issues. But the point is that the parties overwhelmingly crafted these proposals. And that's important to note. And obviously for the few items, literally one or two or three items that we couldn't get to a resolution, we have a process that is fair where all parties choose the arbitrator and all parties, I think, ultimately win because, you know, their members are working and the kids are in school, which is what matters most to the premier, what matters most for Donna, for Neil Lumsden, for Donna Scully, for myself, for all of us who represent families and children. Our bottom line was keeping kids in class. That's what our mission was. And look, I think a lot of families are just sort of breathing a sigh of relief that they know that their kids are going to have some peace, some stability back in the life of a child.
All right. Only got a few seconds left, Minister. And I'm sorry I didn't ask you this earlier, but the whole thing about the solar eclipse, April 8th, we know it's coming at 3:18. Hamilton's right in the sweet spot of all of this. Many were hoping for an educational experience out of this. What's your take?
Look, I mean, I'm a big believer in using these experiences, rare as they may be. You know, last time we're talking a generation ago. I'm a big believer in using these as teachable moments because for all of us who've gone through the partial eclipses, maybe not the full eclipse, but we've gone through other examples like this, it was really an awesome experience for the kids to learn hands-on about the dynamic nature of science and astronomy and inspire young people to literally reach higher and look higher. I think that was an exciting day for kids for many years. And so I believe we should be harnessing the good of learning on that day. But at the end of the day, school boards can move a professional development day. So these are a day where the teachers would be off doing professional development regardless. So they want to move the day with tons of notice, giving families 2 months of notice. You know, I can live with that, to be honest with you. What I will not accept and what I've spoke out against was the unilateral closure of schools where a school board thought it was wise or some school boards or some local unions thought it was acceptable to send their members home and essentially just close the schools for the day because there weren't any more PD days. Not acceptable and totally not fair. I want people in schools, the worker in schools, doing what they do well, which is keeping the kids motivated, sticking to the curriculum, and trying to encourage more learning around STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And so, you know, that's sort of where I'm at. I think a lot of families are there too. I've heard a ton of feedback of people saying, look, stand up for our kids. This should be a cool day for the kids to learn. And I'm doing that. And obviously appreciate that many boards, the majority of boards, vast majority, are going to keep the eclipse at the front and center in the sense of using it as an anchor for learning that day. And they're going to be in school. That's awesome. And I love to see it. I would just want
Stephen
to families to speak to their kids about being safe that day. That's all I can say.
Yeah, don't look up. That's one thing. Stephen Lecce with us, Minister of Education, Province of Ontario. As always, Stephen, thank you for the time. Be well.
Thank you.
Don't go away. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Obviously, you heard, I think it was last weekend, like last Sunday, it was like a week ago, there had been a cybersecurity incident at City Hall. And if you've tried to get in touch or whatever with certain situations, they are keeping essential services and everything up and running, but it's obvious they're having some difficulty. Let's bring in David Shipley, cybersecurity expert, CEO of Beauceron Security, and here now. David, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I am. Thanks for the opportunity.
This appeals to, or appears to be ransomware. What do we know about this specific attack?
Well, we know the impact it's having. So it's brought all phone lines down. It's had an impact on everything from public health campaigns for measles and other vaccinations for high school students. And there's no timeline for full restoration of services, including online payments for permits, service requests, et cetera. So it's the standard I guess sadly say, the standard mix of chaos that happens when a municipality has a massive cyber attack.
So how does this happen? What's the process? So City Hall's there and business as usual, and then what happens?
So what typically happens is international ransomware gangs build highly sophisticated sets of tools and services, and they rent or lease those services in exchange for a portion of any extortions generated. So an affiliate will often hire these services, and they will hit all kinds of targets. And they love hitting municipalities because they cause such pain, and so many have paid. And what happens is either they send things like phishing emails, and they gain access. They look for folks who may have reused usernames and passwords, and they'll try and brute force or digitally lockpick their way into accounts. And this is particularly successful in organizations that don't have universal multi-factor authentication for all IT services. They'll look for unpatched systems and servers, like what happened to Global Affairs Canada, which is its VPN was hacked because it had a software vulnerability. So these are kind of the tried and true ways in, and it is impossible to prevent all possible attacks when there's an entire industry. And to give you some context, just this past couple of days, one of the largest healthcare providers in the United States, called United Health, had their prescription service used by 67,000 pharmacies, including the US military, hacked, and they have reportedly paid a $22 million ransom. And so ransomware, big business. Municipalities getting absolutely hammered. And if you can only put your goalie out as the NHL hockey team, then sooner or later, someone is going to score a goal against you.
So when do they come to ask you for money for these services back? Like, obviously, things start slowing down, things start getting compromised. Then what happens?
Well, usually you get, by the time they decide to execute, and keep in mind that completely messing up a municipal IT system, everything can go from normal to complete chaos in as little as 60 minutes. And typically they'll wait for evenings, weekends. They know that these teams aren't 24/7 because they're just not resourced for it. So sometimes even faster than an hour and they've got you. And then usually right off the bat, all of your devices are going to display the ransom notes with the unique line to get a hold of the chat, where operators are standing by to negotiate, to prove what they have. And sometimes they do things like a double extortion attack, where not only did they get into your network and encrypt your files, but before they pulled the trigger and got your attention, they stole a whole bunch of sensitive information about your clients, customers, citizens in this case, and threatened to release it if you don't pay. So they've got two ways of squeezing you.
So do we just assume that the city of Hamilton is going to have to pay something in order to get this all restored?
Not necessarily. Some cities have shown significant leadership, like the city of St. John, which was sadly the previously largest city in Canada hit with a ransomware attack, which now Hamilton unfortunately takes that title because it's 10 times the size of the city of St. John. They didn't pay. It cost them about $3 million to recover. They made the difficult decision, and it took up to a year for all services to come back the way that they were. But they chose to build back better, and I hope the city of Hamilton does not consider paying, because some may say, well, they're going to pay just to make sure the data doesn't get leaked. And in the recent breakup of the Lockbit gang by international law enforcement, they discovered that Lockbit still held on to data, even though they had promised people who had paid that they had deleted it.
So your recommendation to companies is not to pay. Is that, or does it depend on the situation?
The only exemption I give to my strong advice to not pay is healthcare data, because then you're talking about life-saving, life-preserving, access to timely care. It's really difficult for me to make that pronouncement, but I can tell you that the pattern of continuing to pay these ransoms has just resulted in more and more and more misery. So sooner or later, the only effective way to stop this, short of a cruise missile strike on these Russian-based international gangs, which is not going to happen, is stop paying them.
If you get hit once, are you to assume you're going to be hit again if you don't pay?
Well, certainly if you pay and you don't do all the work of cleaning up and building back better, you can almost guarantee it nowadays. And there are numerous examples of this. In fact, it emboldens the criminals just to wait and come back again. So paying is by no means a smart long-term strategy.
Is building back better cheaper than paying, or is it more expensive?
Generally, in the short term, it seems more expensive. And don't make a mistake. These criminals price their demands, factoring that in, so that if you're solely looking at the business logic of it, it seems more affordable to pay. And that's what they want. But in the long run, investing in building secure, resilient infrastructure is key. Now, here's what we all owe as citizens, because it's convenient to blame politicians. Even more so, folks who get blamed are often the IT leaders or the bureaucracy within these organizations. But don't forget that municipalities in particular respond to the demands of their citizens. And nobody, no citizen in Canada has gone to their mayors and council and said, spend more on security and less on roads.
Yeah, I hear you. So impossible to police, impossible to enforce, impossible to catch these people?
Possible with some wins. So we saw an international concerted law enforcement effort led by the FBI and the United Kingdom's National Crime Agency took down the biggest gang so far, Lockbit. And then they were back in 7 days. So there's value in raising the cost of committing cybercrime. If you have countries that not only support this, but encourage it because it's an important part of their economy, high Russia, North Korea, Iran, then you can't eliminate it. There's no norms or international consensus. No one wants to start a war over ransomware. So there's no way to stop it. There's no way to be perfect in our defense. And so the only way that I can see going forward is to crack down on cryptocurrency, which is the massive enabler of all this crime, and to make it illegal to pay ransoms. But in the short term, and Parliament missed this, and I've chastised them privately and publicly about this, is we need a national ransomware registry where all organizations have to register with the federal government payments that they're making, so we can get a handle on the scope of this problem in Canada.
David Shipley, cybersecurity expert and CEO of Boceron Security, talking about many, many cybersecurity breaches, including the city of Hamilton. David, thanks for the time and insight. Be well.
You too.
Couple of things to talk to Dr. Sylvain Charlebois about. Canada's biggest grocers are investing money and space into the discount chains. We'll talk about that, as well as price surging. Dr. Sylvain Charlebois with us, professor of food distribution and policy, director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie, and here now. Sylvain, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Very well. How about you?
I'm doing very well. I see your face everywhere. Man, this is a situation that is not going away. Affordability, affordability, affordability. Let's start with the grocers, the chains themselves, because we've seen them do the walk of shame in front of politicians and such. But now, are they investing more time and energy into discounted spaces, discounted stores?
Yeah, it's not necessarily news. We've seen this this trend for many months now. I mean, basically, when the market goes frugal, grocers adjust. We heard, I think it was 2 weeks ago, Loblaws was reinvesting $2 billion in its network. They do that every year. It's nothing new. And it was announcing that it was opening 40 stores. They're probably going to be closing at least half of that, if not more. But it's all about readjusting to a market that is looking for more bargains. So expect more no frills, expect more Freshcos and things like that. I mean, those are the banners that are becoming increasingly successful when consumers are looking for deals.
And again, they all own the same one, so why not just lower prices in the main store than, putting more effort into your discount chains?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's actually have all the same products sold at the same exact price in all of the grocery stores in Canada. Huh? Hmm? That looks like communism to me. Here's the thing, because in your neck of the woods, you have stores like Fortino's, okay, or Longo's, mm-hmm. maybe, in your area.
Yep.
Those are premium banners. A customer going into these stores are not the same customers as customers going to No Frills, or at least mm-hmm. expectations aren't the same. That's what's beautiful about free markets. Free markets tend to offer more options and more competition to consumers, and we need to continue to expect that. What I find quite troubling the last couple of years, Scott, to be honest, is that it seems as though everyone expects everyone to offer the same product at the same price. If you're not doing that, you're gouging. Mm. It doesn't make sense, because like Fortino's or say No Frills will have a different approach to distribution and branding than say Longo's or Farm Boy.
We talked about surge pricing last week. Wendy's talking about introducing this, the fast food chain. By the time you could get anybody on to talk about it, they had quickly changed and reversed their decision on this. But when you think about it, surge pricing's been in the grocery industry forever. Supply, demand, seasonal, that sort of thing. Is that not the same?
Well, surge pricing suggests that that dynamic pricing can only go one way up. which is not the case. Actually, dynamic pricing is about adjusting pricing in real time based on demand. And so sometimes, yes, prices can go up when demand is up. But when there's nobody in the store, or if the demand for a certain product is down, prices will likely drop. That's kind of what Metro in Europe is doing. So Metro has adopted dynamic pricing in retail a few months ago. So if by, say, 5 o'clock, apples aren't selling, well, they go half price. That's basically what dynamic pricing is.
Are we going to see more of this?
I do believe that. So it's already happening. When you think about it, commodity prices are set that way. I mean, if people want corn, well, guess what? Corn prices go up. And so it's catching up to retail. But with retail, you need AI. And because of AI's evolution, now, I mean, everyone is using AI with ChatGPT and chatbots. We've democratized AI in a sense, so expectations are different. I think last week with M. Wendy's call of admitting that they were using dynamic pricing, I think it had a lot to do with the fact that, well, everyone knows what AI is, so might as well talk about it. The reality is that it's not going to go away. It's going to continue to grow. I don't think the industry is going to talk about it because, well, consumers don't see the upside. And that's what they need to work on. They need to make sure that consumers see the upside of dynamic pricing. And right now, all consumers are seeing is gouging.
Dr. Sylvain Charlebois with us, Professor of Food Distribution and Policy, Director of the Agri-Food Analytics Lab at Dalhousie. Sylvain, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Take care, Scott.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
We talked about PharmaCare last week. You might remember we were lucky enough to have Jagmeet Singh, leader of the federal NDP, booked in for the Friday that he actually made the announcement. So it was quite exciting when he got to talk about it on the show, a very historic moment he billed it as. And I was very surprised. Number one, there wasn't a lot more details about what it actually involved in really its two categories, birth control and diabetes. And the federal government was really no part of this. Justin Trudeau wasn't around for this, quote, historic announcement. Let's bring in Andre Picard from the Globe and Mail. His latest, the proposed new PharmaCare program is yet another pilot project with an uncertain future. And to talk more about that, Andre Picard, health columnist for the Globe and Mail here now. Andre, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Yes, thank you.
Who wants this, Andre? Because I remember in the time afterwards, we were talking to the Ontario Pharmacy Association, and they weren't calling for this. They want more of a mixed plan than this one. It seems like a long way to go to get here. The Pharmacy Association say that the provinces are best equipped to do this. They've got these programs already in place. They just lack the funding. Where is this going? Is this just a lot of smoke and mirrors to keep the current government in? Is there really a PharmaCare plan here?
Well, I think there is some smoke and mirrors. I think there is sort of a dream of having a pharmacare plan, but the only party that's really enthusiastic about it is the NDP. The Liberals are lukewarm. They're doing what they can to stay in power, but there's not a lot of meat on this. It starts off with a couple of drug categories, as you mentioned, but then where it goes from here is not entirely clear. There's not really any funding. There's no timetable. There's going to be difficult negotiations with the provinces and private insurers. There's a lot more that's not done than it's been done.
When you hear people getting diabetes medications or birth control, yeah, who wouldn't want that? It sounds like a great idea. But is this the most efficient way to deliver this to a very small segment of the population?
Well, that's the question. A lot of people get these drugs already. They have private plans or some public plans. To me, what we should be targeting is people who really can't afford drugs, diabetes and otherwise, and make sure they, you know, we kind of fill in the gaps. There's a lot of gaps in our pharma coverage, but the vast majority of people already do have drug plans. So should we replace them with something at great cost, or should we focus on filling the holes?
And of course, we just came out of a global pandemic, and it's been exposed that our healthcare system wasn't quite as strong as what we had all thought it was or hoped that it would be. And during the global pandemic, we pledged that we were going to fix the weak links in our healthcare. Are you concerned that we're just rubber stamping another plan that is doomed to the same sort of debate and question that healthcare is?
Yeah, we, you know, there obviously there's a lot to do in our healthcare system. We should be, you know, very cognizant of how to best spend our money, and I'm not convinced this is it. At the same time, you know, we have to make sure that we do expand Medicare. It's out of date. We're the only country in the world that only covers physicians and hospitals fully. We have to bring other things. We've got a dental plan, which is actually very different from the drug plan. So there's some philosophical confusion here on part of the ruling party as well.
Are you surprised that the Prime Minister and the government wasn't more a part of this? It seemed to be the NDP show. And then I guess by March 1st, the Health Minister made a statement. But again, there just doesn't seem to be, as you said, meat on the bone here.
Yeah, not too surprised. When there's an announcement that doesn't have money, it's not the most important thing. It's not top of mind. The Finance Minister came out and said, listen, this isn't going to impact us. We're going to make sure this doesn't cost too much. And those are signals. Those are signals that they're going to go very slowly and cautiously on this and do as little possible to fulfill their agreement and still stay in power.
What about timeline? Any idea whatsoever, or do you think this is just going to get punted down the field?
Well, the big question is, will this legislation, which is pretty basic, will it actually get passed before there's an election, or will it just die on the order paper? Because in the meantime, what this bill says the federal government has permission to go negotiate with provinces about these two drug classes. So it's, you know, go and talk to other people. These government discussions don't have a history of going quickly. In my column, I give an example of we have a rare disease strategy that was unveiled exactly a year ago. It called for $1.5 billion in spending, similar to this new bill. And rare diseases is really a no-brainer. Everybody needs help paying for those drugs. There's no question. And still, after a year, there's not a single agreement between the provinces. So if that takes a year, this one will certainly take much longer.
Anything to learn from this exercise that we've just gone through?
Well, I think there's the same lesson comes up over and over again. In Canada, we do things in a piecemeal fashion. We love little pilot projects that make us feel better, but we don't really have any vision for ultimately what do we want Medicare to look like. It's a great philosophy. No one should be denied essential care because of an inability to pay. That's a wonderful philosophy, but you have to give it life. And we haven't given that life in Canada. We did in the 50s and 60s. But the Medicare program we have, society has outgrown it. We have much greater needs now for prescription drugs, for home care, dental care, long-term care. All these things have to be figured into a public plan, but it has to be supplemented by private insurance. So we have to do something we've always been reluctant to do in Canada, and that's draw some lines. What can we afford to cover publicly, and what's covered privately? That's what other countries do much better than us. They're very clear with their population. Here's what we're going to cover, and you're responsible for the rest. We don't do that. We're all over the map in Canada. It depends where you live, what kind of job you have. It's a real, it's often been described as a postal code lottery.
Hmm. Andre Picard with us, health columnist for the Globe and Mail. His latest, the proposed new PharmaCare program, is yet another pilot project with an uncertain future. Andre, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We've talked at length for a while now regarding the Winnipeg lab, top secret stuff going on there, and obviously interference by the Chinese Communist Party that led to two of their scientists being escorted out. And now we're trying to find out exactly what happened and what the records show as to why and how this actually all happened. Let's bring in Charles Burton, senior fellow with the Center for Advancing Canada's Interest Abroad at the Macdonald Laurier Institute, and is here now. Charles, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. It's good to speak with you.
So do we know, or will we know, exactly why these two were escorted out? And are you concerned or convinced that this is now secure? Is there still a relationship between this lab and China?
Evidently, there's still a relationship between the lab and China. Of what nature, we're not sure. But when that question came up, they suggested that there still was that international collaboration, but not the relationship that it evidently had prior to the two scientists, Chiu Xiangguo and Cheng Keding, being frog marched out of there by the RCMP, along with a whole lot of Chinese nationals that were working in this classified level four a microbiology lab, you know, a very secure facility. But you recall that when this incident occurred, the Public Health Agency of Canada refused to provide any information whatsoever, initially saying it was a personnel matter. Then they changed their tune a bit and said it was a national security matter, which is why they couldn't provide the information. Then, Parliament, the whole of Parliament, censored the head of the Public Health Agency of Canada and had him appear before the bar of Parliament, a very ancient practice where he was admonished by the Speaker. Then the Speaker made a ruling that the government had to provide these documents to the Committee of Parliament, whereupon the government then decided in an extraordinary measure to sue the Speaker through the courts. Mm. And then the government dissolved. They called an election and the matter dropped until the government came back to power, gave it to a committee that was agreed to by all the parties. And now 632 pages of documents the government said couldn't be released are all of a sudden released. And the information in them is absolutely shocking.
Why does it appear that the government does not seem interested in getting to the bottom of this, even though there's lots of allegations of election interference? There's lots of evidence of all of this, but we seem to be using everything's top secret as a way to getting to the bottom of this. Why does it appear, or maybe it's just me, that they're just not interested in this and getting to the bottom of it? They're more interested in hiding it.
I think they're pretty interested in not getting to the bottom of it. I mean, you know, the revelations are that Dr. Chiu, a Canadian citizen, had on the sly been engaged in research paid for by the Chinese government at the Wuhan Institute for Virology, which is, you know, where we suspect that the COVID-19 mm-hmm. started from. And even more, you know, the allegation is that she was involved in the research on these bat viruses and gain of function activities, which are, you know, designed to find out what you do to make viruses even more virulent. So she has connections with that institution. She has connections with a number of military institutions and other institutions. She was awarded a major prize by China for her contribution to China, but she is a Canadian citizen. And these activities, such as her receiving money from the Chinese state, her travel to China being subsidized by China, were initially denied by them until CSIS provided the evidence. Now the two scientists have disappeared. So you know, they were frog marched out in 2019. It's now 2024. They still haven't been charged with anything. No trial has taken place. And there's no explanation as to why the government agreed to allow non-Canadian citizens without clearance to work in this very sensitive lab, including one time when one of the Chinese nationals working in the lab evidently attempted to smuggle vials of some substance out of the lab and were caught by security at the door, and the stuff was returned. So, I mean, the revelations are absolutely shocking, and the allegations really need to be pursued. But just yesterday, when the Conservatives raised the idea that there should be a further investigation by Parliament, the Liberals and the NDP voted it down. And the attitude of our Minister of Health, Mark Holland, is, well, you know, we didn't know how serious this was back then, but now we do. But nobody will be made accountable for any of the very serious allegations, not least of which the two Canadian scientists who cannot be located. We presume they've returned to China.
But still Canadian citizens.
Definitely Canadian citizens. But, you know, why would we... Who gave the permission for the Chinese military people to work in that lab? And you know, why hasn't the scientist been sanctioned for unauthorized collaborative research with Chinese units? So, you know, we know a lot from the 632 pages, some of which, incidentally, has been redacted, but most of it hasn't. But there are also probably other things that we don't know about yet. But the government doesn't want to have any further investigation. And the question is, why not? No, we get to the bottom of it, right?
What about the timeline here, Charles? Because this all happened around the time, as you mentioned, the committees were all shut down because the Prime Minister called an election during the pandemic. And then there was also the vaccine deal with CanSino in China that was supposed to be, they were working on some vaccine, and then they ended up just stealing the intellectual property and taking off with it. What about the timeline around all of this?
Well, I mean, certainly... You know, the suspicions about Dr. Chiu occurred as early as 2018. Apparently, the way it was found out was that CSIS somehow or other found her name on a patent that had been applied for in China with regard to viruses. And, you know, it was based on work that had been done in Winnipeg. So that's what tipped them off. Then they continued their investigation and found all of this really shocking and concerning material. But then, you know, wouldn't you have thought that at that stage that the two scientists would have been charged with crimes against Canada, and, you know, there would have been a process in court, but that did not happen. It seems quite similar to the government's attitude towards the foreign interference, where they receive very serious concerns from intelligence services, which the intelligence services can't act on it. They can't, you know, they can't lay charges. It's up to the government authorities to do that. So they receive these concerns. The expectation would be that the charges would be laid and people would be brought to be made accountable in a court of law, given, you know, presumption of innocence. But then no one seems to be arrested. And then while these scientists that the RCMP says are still under investigation 4 years later are evidently able to leave the country and not be able to be located to be questioned or brought to court. So the whole thing seems very suspicious, but maybe there's a good explanation, but the government evidently doesn't want us to find out about that.
Charles Burton with a senior fellow with the Center for Advancing Canada's Interests Abroad at the Macdonald Laurier Institute, the ongoing Winnipeg lab scandal, and how two scientists got there in the first place and where they are now. Charles, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
I hope we can talk about it some more. You know, the Winnipeg, Wuhan, COVID-19 connection is certainly one we'd like to get clear.
Scott Radley, host of the Scott Radley Show. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Good to chat with you, Scott.
You as well. Glad you're back. It would say, you know, I think we really confuse people when I fill in for you and they think, is your voice just, is it a different voice? What's going on? Is he sick? Anyway.
that, The funny thing is I keep getting email as if I'm here. And of course, they're listening to you and they don't even figure that
it's,
out.
It's okay. You well, you know what? It's tricky. It's, you know, if we can get Rick to change his name to Scott, which I've been working on with him, then we're all set.
That's right. We, you know, we got 500 Wills. Why not Scott's as well? All right. Lots going on today. Were you really busted up with Facebook and Instagram going down for like an hour today?
Oh, man. Can we keep it down for another week or two?
No, I know.
Start,
I think
please
it's,
start.
I'm hoping social media all crash. What do you think would happen? Honestly, what do you think would happen to our society if all social media went black for like a month and if it was a cyber attack like in Hamilton and nothing worked? I think it would be fascinating.
It'd get noisy because everybody be talking.
Yeah.
It's like, what's everybody talking about? Why is everybody? I mean, how often do you go? And I've talked about this many times. Go into a restaurant and you'll see like 12 people at a family at a dinner table, and none of them are talking. They're all looking at their device.
I think it would be a really, really interesting thing to see how people would deal this.
Yeah, I don't know how prevalent this is because I'm not on Instagram or anything. Like, I do what I have to do and then that's it. I don't put pictures up of this. I don't, but it's amazing how many members of my family spend time just watching really stupid 5 to 10 second videos of dogs falling in pools or kids doing something. It's like Dick Clark and Ed McMahon's bloopers and practical jokes nonstop. Like, who would have thunk that these guys back then hit the nail on the head?
It does, again.
It's like the earliest days of the internet when we used to send all this sort of weird stuff around.
But see, Scott, I'm not even as interested in, okay, what happens if farting dog videos suddenly go away?
I'd watch that one.
It's more the idea of if people couldn't post their comments on everything, if people couldn't have their loud screaming opinions about everything, would they redirect those into conversations? Now, they may be loud screaming conversations, but at least they would be real. At least they would be with other people, which is far healthier in my mind. I mean, people may think you and I are just, you know, biased and okay, we are, but I think that radio, for example, is better than social media because you have humans who are conversing and talking and voices and people and not just hiding behind the anonymity of a keyboard screaming at people with the name, you know, whatever that you've put on there and no one knows who you are. I would love for social media to crash for a month or two. I think it would be great for everybody.
But see, at the end,
not already predicting the purge, Scott, is sad and concerning.
See, this is what happens, and this is what we wanted. We wanted to give everybody a voice. Why should just you and I have this platform to communicate back in the old days that had so much power? So now everybody has a voice. And unfortunately, when you give everybody a voice, you get the good, bad, and the ugly.
I don't have any objection to everybody having a voice for sure. We open the lines here. Now, not everybody can be sitting here. That just isn't realistic. So, okay, social media there. So my comment on that would then be, Scott, I would love for the social media companies to demand that you put your name and face on your posts. And then everybody's got a voice. But I think it changes things dramatically because suddenly you are responsible for your comments. And what we have right now is people say, I want to have a voice, but I don't want to tell you who I am who's having the voice. Hmm. So if you, or I mean, when I say you, the great you, if your Twitter or your Instagram or your Facebook has your name and your face and you say what you want to say, I got no problem with that whatsoever. Say whatever you want. It can be good. It can be bad. We can agree. We can disagree. But at least you're standing behind it. It's the anonymous crap that tends to be most of the crappiest of the crap that I just find to be, I would dream of the day when everybody who does not attach their name to their comments is purged off the internet, just like Tom just mentioned, the purge. That's who we should be purging. You want to put your name behind it? I'm all for it.
I think we're going to take, Tom, take Scott's line of saying the crappiest of the crap, and I want that put into a liner for tomorrow.
Already working on it.
But do you, Scott, do you not agree, though? Do you not agree that if people stand behind their comments, we're all, then everyone gets their voice and everyone's fine with it? I just find it so funny when they want a voice, but then don't want to identify the voice.
The anonymous voice.
The anonymous. And it's like driving your car in tinted windows and just extending your hand out the window and giving the finger. Roll down your window if you're going to give someone the finger. Let them see who it is.
Let me see the face behind that finger. All right, there you go. The conversation continues after 6 o'clock tonight with the Scott Radley Show, and you can read them in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a great one, Scott. Thanks again.
Thanks, Scott. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one, email from Rob. Instead of taking advantage of a free hour they'll never get back when Facebook and Instagram went down due to technical difficulty today, Facebook and Instagram users were left crying, huddled in the fetal position, and having to communicate face-to-face. Never again! Keep right, except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.